Today is May the 8th, 2007, and we're on Exposed on spyman.ca, and I'm Agent Ladybug, and we have the most important show that you'll ever hear. Today we're honored to have on two guests, along with Eric Huffschmid and myself. We're going to be asking questions, and we're honored to have on David Hawkins, a forensic economist, and Captain Field McConnell. And this will be a powerhouse of a show because we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of a lot of questions. Now, welcome both of you. I'll ask both of you to just say hello to our guest. David Hawkins first.
Oh, hello, Ladybug. Thank you for having us back on. Well, I think this is the first time you've had Field and myself, so we look forward to revealing some of the mysteries around 911 and being any help we can.
Wonderful. And now, Field?
Yes, good afternoon, Agent Ladybug. It's a pleasure to be with you and Eric, and we're ready for whatever you may have on your mind.
Now, this is the most important show that I think anyone will hear. Field McConnell was born in 1949, and he started out, he was a USAF bomber pilot at one point, his father was, and his mother was a World War II Army nurse, and what he had gotten into was got into the U.S. Naval Academy in 1967, then he worked his way into the U.S. Marine Corps pilot. He was also a pilot from 1977 to 1993 in North Dakota, and then he also retired as a lieutenant colonel, and he worked from 1978 to 2007 as a pilot for Northwest Airlines. And he early retired because it was due to being a whistleblower on 9/11. So this is highly important of why he became a whistleblower. So, Field, how did you get involved in this 9/11? What provoked you to get involved with unraveling what you have?
Well, Agent Ladybug, you made mention of the fact that I graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy. One of the 9/11 pilots, Captain Chick Burlingame, the pilot of American 77, which is reported to have flown into the Pentagon, which I am confident is a false report. He was my college classmate, and that piqued my interest, as you might imagine, when one of your college mates flies into a building or is reported to have done so, because it makes one realize philosophically that that could have been the other way around, and I could have been the one that had that experience, not Chick Burlingame. And he's no longer with us to defend himself or to seek justice, so I decided that I'd try to learn whatever I could about the events of 9/11 and try to make sense of it, because even on the day it occurred, which was September 11th of 2001, it didn't look right to me. I could not imagine any pilots in the United States of America, or Canada for that matter, Western Europe, any professional pilots being forced under any conditions to fly into a building. And if the pilots didn't fly into a building, I also knew instinctively that someone, not because they're Muslims and not because they're terrorists, not because they're from a different part of the world, but simply because these pilots had fewer than 50 hours in an airplane, there's no way in the world that they could have flown that precisely. And therefore, starting on 9/12, the day after 9/11, I started reading as much as I could, and I've never read anything that, not from my perspective, that lends credence to the official story. And when you start eliminating the impossible, then whatever's left, however unlikely it might be, is most certainly the truth. So I've been coming from that background for 5 years, and then it was my pleasure to cross tracks with David Hawkins about 6 months ago. And we believe that within probably the first 60 days we cooperated, that we had sufficient details to bring legal charges of wrongful death.
Now, this is pending in court right now. You filed a document last week, is that correct?
Yes, on May Day, which I think is appropriate, because when pilots are having an emergency in the aircraft, for instance, if all three or four of your engines quit, you would pick up the radio and say, Mayday, And what that does is it gets the other pilots on that frequency to be quiet so you can communicate. Mayday indicates that the person making the transmission of Mayday has a big problem and they'd like to get a little help resolving the problem. The lawsuit should have been filed perhaps 5.5 years ago. But of course we didn't have that information 5.5 years ago. But the information hasn't changed. The facts, the material facts of the case have not changed since they transpired. And as an American, I'm a little bit disappointed in our investigative services like the FBI and the CIA, because if David Hawkins and I, as two private citizens who've never met each other, can come up with this type of an evidence, it makes me wonder what our tax dollars are going for. And secondly, now that the research has been done and the dots have been connected, I'm sort of surprised that there's not people in positions of authority contacting us for support and seeking justice for what was the worst thing to happen in the United States of America, I would say, since Pearl Harbor Day in 1941.
Well, I was rather dumbfounded when I was trying to get into the website Hawks Cafe in
yes.
the local library. It's being knocked off, so you can't even get in.
That's a great compliment.
So this is rather interesting. Now, David Hawkins, how did you get involved? You're a forensic economist, and how did you get involved as well into this whole thing with Field McConnell?
Well, I suppose, Ladybug, I gave myself the title. My background is engineering and troubleshooting, and with a lot of experience in building improvised explosive devices and advanced computing techniques in the international oil industry, including in a different industry, in the military industry, you'd call what I did a virtual war room. It's the ability to collect data from the internet or whatever computer tools are available and assemble what the military people would call a common operational picture. So this was, let's say, second nature to me. And when I saw the events and tried to string together a theory that would explain those events and facts around 9-1-1, in particular, the general recognition that the pilots, the alleged Muslim hijackers, were incapable of flying large passenger jets, it was patently obvious that they couldn't execute the maneuvers, for example, the one that took out the U.S. Naval Command Center in the Pentagon. So, as Field says, and as Sherlock Holmes said, you have to exclude the impossible, and if it was impossible for a Muslim hijacker to execute those maneuvers, then they didn't execute those maneuvers. They had to be executed by an advanced command and control system. And the only people on the morning of 9/11 using advanced command and control systems, military quality command and control systems, were the two sides of the so-called Global Guardian war game. And the great pleasure and privilege I've had with meeting up with Field McConnell is I, as an engineer, predominantly land-based and offshore-based in the oil industry, I couldn't imagine what it must be like to be a pilot in a large passenger jet, being hijacked, and what kind of maneuvers I would be capable of doing that would disable the hijackers. Or secondly, being a pilot in a fast flight interceptor jet, which can fly at 1,850 miles an hour at top speed, why I wouldn't be able to intercept these planes and protect the capital. And finally, what we, Field and I, have done is we've analyzed the command and control system that was sabotaged on 9-1-1 by Canadian intelligence that was representing the Red Team attackers during the Global Guardian war game. So the combination of myself as a forensic economist, and Field has joined the group now as a founder member of this Hawks Cafe's Citizens Association of Forensic Economists, we can now visualize both sides of the equation, what it would like to be a Red Team attack commander in Canada, and what it would be like to be a Blue Team defense commander in the United States, in the Pentagon, for example. And we now understand the fraud that was committed on 9-1-1.
So this is highly important, all these things that you've uncovered. Name some of the some of the plaintiffs involved, and then also who are the defendants? Who are involved in this whole civil suit matter, and where was it filed? What court?
Well, shall I, maybe I could talk on behalf of the plaintiffs, although the lead plaintiff is obviously Field McConnell, and perhaps Field can identify some of the key defendants and why we've named them as defendants in this, probably what might prove to be the biggest civil racketeering claim in the history of the United States. As far as the plaintiffs are concerned, Hawks Cafe formed a Yahoo group in September of last year. And anyone can visit the website, which is hawkscafe.com. And when they visit that website, they'll see what's really described as an archive of my work. But now it's very much a joint venture, a joint effort between Field and myself, including the text of this case that was filed in Fargo on May the 1st. And so people coming to our website, hawkscafe.com, can then, by subscribing, it doesn't cost any money, join the Yahoo group. We set up that Yahoo group in September of last year under the intelligence section of Yahoo. And there are, or were, around 2,100 Yahoo groups organized under the intelligence section of Yahoo. And we are now, I believe, the third largest in the world intelligence group. Perhaps more accurately, I would describe it as the Citizens Counterintelligence Group under Yahoo, which I think is quite an achievement. We have 700 members. So all of these are prospective plaintiffs, and the discipline that we would recommend to people who think they might like to be a plaintiff in this huge case is that they first of all study the writings on the Hawks Cafe and then also on the Yahoo group. There's an immense amount of rather technical material, and I might come in a minute to the one way that we are communicating to a less technical audience. But anyway, by joining the Yahoo group, they can become one of 700, and we hope by the time this case actually comes into court, we'll have 10,000 members. And then by contacting Field McConnell or myself through the Yahoo group, they can indicate, first of all, that they would like to volunteer an interest to becoming plaintiffs. And the kind of things that I believe Field and I would both be looking for is that we would only want plaintiffs who are committed and ready to sign to that effect, that they will uphold the American Constitution. Because although I'm a British and Canadian citizen, I believe the letter and the spirit of the American Constitution make it one of the most important documents for freedom and liberty in the world, and those values are universal, they're not just American. So we would, I don't know if recruit is the right word, but we'd be looking for people who are highly informed on at least one or more of the defendant class, that they understand what case we're bringing, which is a claim for punitive and treble damages for wrongful deaths on 9/11/2001. And I'm reading from the first paragraph of this document that Field claimed, resulting from movement of sex sabotage and murder for hire assets by the racketeering use of interstate or foreign commerce networks, financed by private equity, arbitrage, insurance, and hedge fund frauds between October 1970 and September 2001. So the plaintiffs will be going for treble damages under a RICO claim, which is a racketeering influenced and corrupt organization claim, associated with the use and traveling on interstate commerce or foreign commerce networks to execute a murder with a pecuniary compensation paid to the assassin. So perhaps over to you, Field, as far as the defendants are concerned.
Okay, but before I go that direction, I want to point out the reason why these dates are in there, October 1970 and September of 2001. The first date, the October 1970 date, was when the RICO laws took effect, and September of 2001, of course, is when 9/11 occurred. This pattern of behavior and the modus operandi of the murder for hire goes back previous to 1970, but we've limited it to the dates that are protected under RICO. Having said that, I'll start giving some of the defendants, and some of these names are a little difficult to pronounce, so rather than read all 100, I'll just take some key ones, but to challenge myself with pronunciation, Mohamed Al-Zabik is a Team Canada-China 2001 member, and he's a private equity group member of CAI up there in Canada, McDonald Detweiler and Associates. James Baker is more of a household name. He's with Carlisle Canada Private Equity Group, and you'll see that there's a common theme here. It's private equity, and most taxpayers or citizens of both nations here, Canada and the U.S., probably are a little disappointed or shocked when they find out who's doing what to whom and whose money they're doing it with. One of the most onerous defendants is Thomas Barnett, and he used his office and the facilities at the U.S. Naval War College to develop a new rule set war game in the North Tower, where Cantor Fitzgerald, a carbon credit trader, and in fact, according to my knowledge, the number one carbon credit trader as of 9/11, with revenues of around $70 trillion a year, that office was completely removed. And in fact, the entire Twin Towers were completely removed, and Carlton Bartels, who ran Cantor Fitzgerald, died in what was characterized, and I'm quoting Thomas Barnett, snuff video. He said that was the biggest live snuff ever videotaped, which I think is a very disrespectful choice of words, and therefore I'd love to meet Thomas Barnett in a courtroom. Further, as a U.S. Naval Academy graduate, I find it repugnant that they're using U.S. Naval War College facilities to basically attack America. Now, this man was an American. Much of the software, the corporations behind the attack, and actually the Canadian military, all bear some guilt here, because the only corporation in the world that had all these tools at their disposal on 9/11 was Carlisle, Canada, according to my information, which I think is quite good. I'll move along here. Another household name you may remember is George Herbert Walker Bush, one of the presidents, the elder of the Bush presidents, and he was associated with Carlisle Private Equity Group. He also was in the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency of the United Nations, and about 11 years prior to 9/11, he gave a speech in the United Nations regarding the New World Order, and I think that many of us in Canada and the U.S., we sort of prefer the Old World Order. Frank Carlucci with Canada Carlisle is the name you Canadians may recognize. He also is associated with Nortel, and Nortel played a big part in the attack. For the Americans, William Jefferson Clinton, Bill Clinton, former president, he was on the NATO Partnership for Peace scam, and he's also a member of the French-American Foundation, which is a common thread here. You're going to see other people that played a part in this are French sympathizers, and his wife included. In fact, this is an alphabetical filing, and so the very next person on the filing as a defendant is Hillary Rodham Clinton. And she was a member of Rose Law Firm, and I'll just stop right there, but I guess I'm getting to be somewhat of an expert, but the two things that I see as the most common threads are Canada Carlisle, Carlisle Canada up north, and Rose Law in Arkansas. And I see a lot of connections to Little Rock, Arkansas, or corporations in Little Rock, and up north, I see a whole lot of threads running through Quebec, and especially Gatineau, Quebec. Moving on with some more names, Canadians will recognize Paul Desmarais Sr. from Canada Carlisle. I keep getting that one back. Carlisle, Canada, excuse me. And Canada Steamship Lines. He also is on the Canada-China Business Council. And here's a new name, AXA, AXA, world's biggest insurance company. And they've got a colorful history of providing insurance for money laundering purposes. I'll give you about two or three more. One of my favorite American defendants is John Deutsch, and he's the discredited former CIA chairman who left the CIA with a whole bunch of computer information that has been used against the United States for the benefit of, I would say, France and China, most likely. I'll give you a couple more. Here's a household name, in fact, two in a row, and then my sister, Al Gore. He's confusing people on environmental issues right now, and he's also the gentleman who made sure that the AT&T virtual private networks telephone system was shipped up to Canada, where the Canadians would then have encrypted telephones, but the American citizens would not. John Kerry, he's got all sorts of ugly things on his resume, and we don't have that much time to cover them all. But then my own sister, whose name is Christine Marcy, I believe she was extorted or entrapped, because I know her as my only sibling, and I don't think that she would willingly do what she apparently has done. But she was with the Department of Justice and several other organizations in the U.S. government. Now she's been privatized, and she's working for, this is just a coincidence, but she's working for Bruce McConnell, same last name as my own, and Bruce McConnell is the head of McConnell International, and McConnell International, from a layman's standpoint, pretty much sells America to anybody who wants to pay for it. So I would say if America is being destroyed, Bruce McConnell's participating every step of the way, one way or the other. And I think that gives you a pretty good feeling for some of the names. Frank McKenna is another name, and Brian Mulroney, you Canadians would recognize. We've got lots of information on all these people. It's not like we just threw darts at a board and then picked the names that came up, but there's a lot of research that's gone into this filing, and we think we've selected the 100 most guilty or most effective defendants, if you will. I'll give you a break.
Boy, this is rather astounding when you have names like Hans Bick, and then you have also the Jimmy Hoffa Jr., the Bonanno family, Joseph Massino. These are crime families working with very high people in high ranks, including Jacques Chirac. Very interesting that these defendants are all amassed in the same lawsuit under the Equity Group banner. So interesting, how long have the organized crime been working with organized crime in high places in all the governments around the world? And this is what it's boiling down to. This is astounding.
Yeah, that's right, and perhaps I could just jump in there, Ladybug. In 1995, the United States Department of Justice filed what is known as a draft RICO complaint. That's a racketeering influence corrupt organization complaint against senior people in the Laborers International Union of North America, which I think back for three general presidents, I think a period of something like 50 years, was considered to be run by organized crime families and operating particularly out of Chicago. And I've read, although it's a huge document, 212 pages with a lot of detail, it would appear that the murder-for-hire operation run under that, or allegedly run under that RICO complaint, was based out of Chicago, where the Daley family has provided dynastic control through City Hall for decades. So Arthur Coyer was the target as the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America for this draft RICO complaint, and had the U.S. Department of Justice done its job. And I believe that Field, McConnell, and I both are of the opinion that by then, in 1995, the Department of Justice had become irredeemably corrupt under Janet Reno and Webster Hubbell, who was number three at the Department of Justice and a former colleague of Hillary Clinton at the Rose Law Firm. And he went to jail, I believe, for 21 months for double billing or fraudulently billing his customers while at the Rose Law Firm. So this is quite extraordinary. You have the number three at the U.S. Department of Justice going to jail. So we can conclude that the Department of Justice was corrupt and taking bribes, and it's absolutely extraordinary. In 1993, Webster Hubbell and Al Gore and Janet Reno, this was just after the election as president of Clinton, and a guy called Leon Panetta and another name that Ron Brown, who was the Secretary of Commerce, who was killed and probably murdered in the air crash over Yugoslavia in 1996. They all met together and they conspired to use drug money confiscated by the Department of Justice from organized crime to buy the entire production of AT&T's secure telephony system, which would otherwise have prevented the National Security Agency and the CIA from eavesdropping into conversations between Americans or potential terrorists abroad. So by paying or bribing AT&T to take on that entire production of a secure telephony system, what, of course, that gave Al Gore and the Clinton White House and the Department of Justice was the possibility of developing a conspiracy inside the United States using money, drug money, confiscated from organized crime by the Department of Justice to launch, we believe, an attack on the American Republic from inside because they had the secure telephony system. And in order to develop that attack outside the reach of RICO, the Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization statute, it would appear, and that will be the purpose or one of the purposes of this court case under discovery, it would appear that they exported the secure technology, telephony from AT&T, plus public key encryption, which was under the control of Bruce McConnell, who has just been mentioned by Phil McConnell, to Canada so that the Canadian intelligence services, which were being corrupted by the Canadian Privy Council, could actually develop a conspiracy outside the reach of RICO or the remedy available to RICO. And what the Clintons did, both Bill and Hillary Clinton, is they saw the threat if the Laborers International Union of North America's pension fund assets and knowledge of blast technicians and saboteurs was taken into a RICO trusteeship. So around February of 1995, they prevailed upon the Department of Justice, I believe by extortion or bribery, Ladybug, to drop the RICO complaint.
Astounding.
And what they did was they drafted in 50 senior FBI officers into the Laborers International Union of North America and allowed the Laborers International Union of North America under a sham operating agreement to police itself. And so what Arthur Coyer, the General Secretary of the Laborers Union, did, it would appear he started cleaning out the classical mobsters in Chicago. And by classical mobsters, I believe, perhaps I'm a fan of The Sopranos, I believe the majority of mobsters from the Italian and Sicilian families in North America are actually quite loyal Americans and Canadians. I mean, they're into breaking each other's heads and periodically killing each other, but they don't generally want an armed revolution to overthrow the state. Contrary to what would appear to be the political objectives of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, who would appear to be closet Marxists with the various sympathizers in Canada, who would like to, and this I think is what we see on 9-1-1, was an attempted coup d'etat to destroy the American Republic. And one has to ask, as I think we've asked several times, what would have happened if United 93 had not been 41 minutes late? It would have destroyed the Capitol building and killed hundreds of congressmen and senators and destroyed the succession and allowed the inside virtual private networks that the Clintons and their equivalents in Canada had confiscated, if you will, or extorted, to run the government through a secure communication system that was not available to the elected representatives of the American people and the Canadian people. So it had huge implications, although the basic implication for us, I think, was that it was a murder for hire racket to conceal a hedge fund fraud in the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So perhaps I'll take a break there, and if you have any questions.
You know, I had one simple question.
Oh, yes, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to clarify what these terms mean, because I'm looking at your document, and you have plaintiffs versus, and then you have a list of names, and then underneath that, you have another list of names you're referring to as co-defendants, and then under that, you have another list that you say are not defendants, but they're co-conspirators. I was just wondering, what's the difference in the list you're calling defendants and then the other list that's under them and then the other list?
Oh, well, to be honest, and I'll be brutally honest, I trained as an engineer. I did a certain amount of law, so my knowledge of RICO statute of the United States is quite derivative, and I looked at the draft complaint filed by the U.S. Department of Justice against the Laborers International Union that, in my opinion, should have been translated into a real case before a jury, and the confiscation of the lunar assets and put into a trusteeship. So I borrowed from the way they structured that document, and with Field and I, we've converted it into a civil claim. So what we've tried to do with the people at the top of this list is we've kind of created a concept which the judge will or the jury will always look for in a RICO claim. First of all, they want to look for the individual defendants having a relationship with a racketeering enterprise, and then they want to make sure that the racketeering enterprise has continuity over time, because the essence of a racketeering claim is against people who may be closer or further away from the heart of the racketeering enterprise and normally be in a position to intimidate witnesses. So what you're really looking for is two criteria, relationship or proximity or closeness of the relationship to the racketeering enterprise, and a definition of a racketeering enterprise that has endured. In our case, we believe it was prior to October 1970, but the RICO remedy was only available in 1970. So the group that you see at the top are the people that we think are closest to the events of 9-1-1 and the RICO enterprise that executed them. So if I just take the name at the top, Mohammed al-Zaibak, he's a Syrian-born, Saudi-educated guy who went to Harvard MBA, Master of Business Administration, and then came into Canada and would seem to have all the characteristics of operating for Syrian intelligence, because he was given by, as a private equity arrangement, access and exclusive right to sell the Canadian hydrographic charts. So this is quite extraordinary, because the Canadian hydrographic charts would give information that would allow hostile force to move its submarines deep into Canadian territorial waters and along the coast into American waters. And so you have to ask yourself, what is a Syrian-born, Saudi-educated guy doing selling information that is of top-secret value to the defense of the Canadian coastline against a submarine attack? He was on the team that was sent to Canada, China, in 2001, that appears to have been discussing with the Communist People's Liberation Army of China a series of war games. This was February 2001, including the Amalgam Virgo war game of June the 1st and 2nd, 2001. And listen to it very carefully. That was a game between Canada and the United States which simulated an Al-Qaeda hijacking attack on America combined with drone missile attack. So when these clowns say this attack on 9/11 came as a total surprise, we know that is that's garbage, because they rehearsed the attack on the 1st and 2nd of June. That is, the Canadian intelligence services, of which I believe Mohammed al-Zaibak is a double agent, practiced attacking America, and the kind of maneuvers necessary to trick the American Air Force into standing down to guarantee the success of the decoy and drone maneuvers on 2011. So Mohammed al-Zaibak was in China on February of 2001, and on June the 1st and 2nd, when they rehearsed the war games in the United States, there was another war game going on halfway around the world, well, across the Pacific, in the Straits of Formosa, where the Chinese People's Liberation Army were rehearsing an attack on an island in the Straits of Formosa that would have been the stepping stone to an attack on the island of Taiwan. So it doesn't take rocket sciences to understand that Mohammed al-Zaibak was a key insider to the bogus war games of the 1st and 2nd of June 2001, right? And a presumed beneficiary of the massive hedge fund fraud through the CAI private equity group, that was executed on 9/11 when they panicked the New York Stock Exchange. The New York Stock Exchange over the next 4 days, because it was sabotaged, lost $1.2 trillion. But those losses in New York were clawed back on the derivatives market in Chicago Mercantile Exchange by the private equity insiders of the war games, of which we have to assume Mohammed al-Zaybak was a beneficiary. So, answer to your question, Eric, the group at the top are the group that we believe have the greatest proximity or closeness to the conspiracy for the 9/11 attack. The group beneath, we believe they have proximity, but they perhaps weren't involved in the conscious mens rea, the guilty mind planning of the 9/11 attack, but we think we have enough evidence to name them as a group of defendants, because when we launched the class action suit, which is for the civil damages, each of these individuals represent a combination of banks, insurance companies, and pension funds, where we want to freeze the money and transfer it back to the American Republic. And then the people below that, the associates of the enterprise, or the racketeering enterprise, noted as alleged co-conspirators, not named as defendants. Well, we've chosen some of those names because they happen to be dead, so it's going to be difficult to bring them into the Fargo court. But Barzan al-Tikriti was the half-brother to Saddam Hussein in Geneva, at the same time as Yaslam bin Laden, who was a member of the Carlyle private equity group. So these two were working together, and between them, they represented the two most deadly and efficient and ruthless assassination networks. And we think we can prove that those two networks were hired by Paul Desmarais of Power Corp of Montreal for the 9/11 attack to execute these complex decoys and drone maneuvers, such that they could be blamed and their networks could be blamed and draw attention of the American public and the Canadian public away from this domestic attack. So in many cases, the people at the bottom are either dead or they're more remote from the core conspiracy that we don't think we'll necessarily be able to prove that they are members of the racketeering enterprise.
I see. And you said
the Right Honorable Pierre Elliott Trudeau, he's deceased, but they've put in his son now as the potential head of the Liberal Party, and this might be a major agenda. He had Marxist-Leninist leanings of Pierre Elliott Trudeau, great friend of Castro. So this might be an agenda that they've long time planned.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, and you see, I believe that in the October 1970 manifesto from the FLQ, the Front de Libération de Québec, which Trudeau put down, I sense from Trudeau's background that he was probably a shill for the Marxist revolutionaries of the Front de Libération de Québec. He was the leader of the Communist Party delegation to Moscow and Peking, or it's now called Beijing. He was a Nazi sympathizer during the Second World War, and apparently was strutting around Montreal wearing a Nazi helmet. His heroes were Salazar, the president of Portugal, Marechal Pétain of Vichy France, and Mussolini. And he was raised in a school of what is sometimes called clerical fascism, which is a very hardline right-wing Catholic movement within the Catholic Church. And I don't think he ever dropped that. He was a revolutionary. He's quoted as saying that justice should not be considered as a framework of order, but an instrument of revolution. So I think he was just playing games with the Canadian, a very gullible public. And I have to say that charisma is the most regrettable quality in politicians, because a charismatic politician tends to distract people's attention from his real agenda, and I believe Trudeau's real agenda will prove to be, and hopefully will prove that in this court case, a revolutionary Marxist regime for North America, combined perhaps reluctantly with organized crime in racketeering controls of industry and production in the global commons.
Now, Eric, you were going to say something.
Oh, I was also going to ask you. You made the remark. You some of those people you couldn't bring into court in North Dakota. What exactly, for those of us that aren't too familiar with this legal business, it's referred to as a civil case in the Fargo courthouse. What exactly is going to be happening next? What could you give like an overview of what this is, and from your point of view, what is this? A lot of legal expenses or time, or what's supposed to happen next?
Would you like to take a run at that field, or shall I?
Well, I can start it out, and you can finish it off.
Okay, go ahead.
What the people on the other side of this lawsuit are expecting to see is they're expecting to see proof of service. In other words, we're supposed to serve the defendants. In fact, it just came today, and David didn't know that, but finally, a week after I filed it, a package from the courthouse was delivered at my mailbox this morning, and in there will be instructions to me to serve the defendants, which means I have to publish documents and deliver them to the courthouse so the courthouse can then send the service, serving a subpoena, not a subpoena, but it's letting the defendants know officially that they have, that they do have defendant status on this court case. And there's probably some nervous people out there. There's probably some that are completely dismissive of this and are not nervous. But anyway, our next move is up to David, myself, and the other principals of this. But to answer your question from my perspective, Eric, is the legal system in the United States, I believe, has been corrupted and for a fairly long time. And this sort of knocks them off balance a little bit, because this is a pro se filing, which means that we do not have an attorney involved. And in the U.S. legal system, there's a term called the court, and the court is the physical courtroom, yes, sometimes. It's the judge, once assigned to the case. It's the attorneys for everyone involved, and the attorneys are also called officers of the court. Now, when I was an officer in the Marine Corps paid me. I don't know how money's handled with judges and attorneys, but as a layman who doesn't have a lot of respect for our system, it appears that it's very difficult to get an attorney to be honest, especially when you're going up big against big, powerful, and wealthy entities or government officials. So that's my layman's explanation of what the people that are defendants, the listed defendants, are expecting to get a service very soon in the mail. And we have 120 days to amend this court case, and we're just waiting to see the reaction we're getting from sympathetic parties. And by the way, David, correct me if I misspeak, but I don't think we've had anybody criticize us for filing this lawsuit. We've had a lot of people that want to become co-plaintiffs, and they want to funnel us information from very high places.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Field. And perhaps we just backtrack a little bit, because I want to just restate the foundation of Hawks Cafe, which spelt out is the Citizens Association of Forensic Economists at Hawks Cafe. We borrow from the concept of the grand jury, which was introduced, I understand, by King Ethelred the Unready in England in the 10th century. And he had a phrase, and I presume that was in Old English, that basically translates means accuse no innocent and shelter no guilty. So I want to make it absolutely clear, we are not accusing any of these defendants of murder. One of the reasons is the simple spoliation of evidence, which is a technical term that the murders of 911 used, and we can prove that, ultra-high temperature accelerants or incendiaries. I've coined a phrase now, I call it a confetti bomb. And the temperature of this bomb is around 5,800 degrees Fahrenheit, and it uses a reaction between aluminum powder and an oxidant such as iron oxide or ammonium perchlorate. And it burns at 5,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And we believe that they use these incendiaries to vaporize or fragment the evidence of murder one, to the point where it's almost impossible, we believe, realistically, to gather evidence and put it in front of a jury. And that's the incredible thing these people should be eternally grateful for, is under the common law system that goes back to Ethelred the Unready, they're entitled for a trial by jury of their peers. And that's one of the greatest defenses against tyrannical, dictatorial, or government abuse that they could ever have. Anyway, we would be asking for a trial by jury. We know we can't get a murder, one conviction, a little like O.J. Simpson, because of the spoliation, removal, or planting of evidence. So the civil remedy that we have under RICO in the United States is to present a claim for damages, punitive and treble damages, for wrongful death. We know that nearly 3,000 people, predominantly American, died wrongfully on the United States. We can't prove that they were murdered with what is known as mens rea or a guilty mind. Tragically, I think these people, the defendants, they considered the people who died on 9/11 as collateral damage in their larger objective of working a hedge fund scam on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So, like I said, and I'll restate that, we're not interested in accusing someone of committing a crime. We do believe we have enough evidence to put in front of a lay jury where we can show that the defendants either used or traveled on interstate or foreign commerce or induced their victims to use or travel on interstate commerce as part of a murder-for-hire network where the assassins were given pecuniary compensation. And we think that the defendants can be proven to have hired two networks of assassins, probably both through Geneva, one group being led by Bazen al-Tikriti, the former head of Iraq's intelligence service, who Saddam Hussein sent to Geneva. And he made an amazing career move from head of Iraqi intelligence. He became the permanent representative of the Iraqi delegation to the United Nations Human Rights Commission. and then Yeslam bin Laden, who obviously had this connection to one of the most effective fighting forces during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, where the CIA had hired that network to help kick the Soviets out of Afghanistan very successfully. And when John Deutsch stole 17,000 pages of top-secret CIA information, what we believe is that he sold or transferred that information, including the identities of CIA operatives in Afghanistan, including Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I believe he sold that information to his domestic friends, who either bribed or extorted those previously loyal CIA agents to become double agents and be used in the 9/11 attack on America. So perhaps...
Go ahead.
Well, that was just my point, but I think it's worth saying again and again and again, this isn't a vindictive exercise. It's a... We're not accusing people of murder or a crime. We're accusing them as being a member or members of a murder-for-hire network that under U.S. code is using people or hiring people to commit a murder for pecuniary compensation, giving the defendants an alibi. And I might just mention something that we picked up on. It's very interesting. When the Front de Libération de Québec began engaging in its bombing of English-speaking targets or English-speaking military forces in Quebec in 1963, the first weapons they used were incendiary bombs. And they engaged, I believe, from memory, in about 200 bombings from 1963 to 1970, including blowing up the Montreal Stock Exchange, because these were the symbolic enemies of the Marxist revolutionary groups embraced by Pierre Trudeau. And they began extorting protection money from banks and financial institutions in Quebec. And according to their manifesto, one of the people they may have been extorting was Paul Desmarais, who is named as a defendant. So by 1970, you had an extraordinary two extraordinary events. One is the RICO statute was introduced in the United States in October 1970. And two, Pierre Trudeau put English-speaking troops into Montreal following the kidnapping and subsequent murder of Pierre Laporte, who actually had the crucifix stuffed down his throat, and he choked on it. And the FLQ said this was an accident. They didn't intend to murder him. But what Trudeau did, and this is where I think the rot began to set in, the FLQ went underground, and at the time of their October manifesto, they claimed to have 100,000 armed men, armed with guns and explosives, ready to overthrow the Quebec government and, for all I know, the Canadian government. But suddenly, after October 1970, the FLQ was no longer mentioned. The people who killed Pierre Laporte were actually spent a brief period, as I understand, in a Quebec jail. And then, Ladybug, they were sent to Cuba.
Cuba.
Right? Where, I suggest, Castro trained them to a much higher level of sophistication to attack targets in the United States. And then they returned to Quebec, and they reintegrated with society. Now, I would suggest, as trained killers that could move seamlessly in and out of jail. And in 1970, when the RICO statute was introduced into the United States, they found the most effective recruiting ground for assassins to be used in murder for hire was in the Arkansas correction system. So you had two things happening after October 1970. The Quebec correction system became a reservoir, or if you will, a university for special weapons and tactics teams used for political or criminal or terrorist killings in a murder for hire operation. And the Arkansas correction system, hence the term Arkanside, was semi-privatized and became a reservoir or a university for crime, terrorist, and murder for hire killers. And what's very intriguing, the weapon of killing, and this is, I believe, as part of a life insurance fraud developed in the Arkansas correction system, was tainted blood. And the tainted blood scam was run through the Rose Law Firm of Little Rock, Arkansas, and apparently the partner that dealt with brokering the tainted blood scam, where I think we can argue that the blood was mined from the prisoners containing AIDS and Hep C virus, et cetera, and injected into military people coming back from Vietnam or innocent Americans and Canadians, after a life insurance had been taken on the innocent victims, because the insurance company knew that these people would die earlier rather than later, and they could launder dirty money through the tainted blood scam. Anyway, in 1976, Hillary Clinton became a partner of the Rose Law Firm. In 1978, she was, she joined the Rose Law Firm as an expert in intellectual property. In 1978, she was promoted to partner by Joe Girouard, who was the chairman of the Rose Law Firm at the time, and a director of BEI Industries that makes the gyrochip we believe was used to fly the planes on 911. So we've got a fascinating group of people closely associated with a private equity investment in the Arkansas correction systems for murder for hire, combined with a group of people with private equity investment in the Quebec prison systems, also affiliated to individuals who would be extremely capable as blast technicians or murderers or assassins.
So this is a brand new game. Now, how does Theodore Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, fit in? Are these a lot of these murder-for-hire people, Manchurian candidates that you see? And I also see something rather interesting with Vito Rizzuto. He just pleaded guilty, but not to be the shooter. And is he going to do time here in Canada? Not in the United States, and he's laughing. There might be a game plan in the end that a lot of these people say that they are dying and quickly put in a double or whatnot and die conveniently in a coffin. No one checks. A coroner just says that was the person, but no one was able to see the cadaver in the coffin. And this might have happened the same thing, well, I believe, with Saddam Hussein. I think a double took the hangman's noose. What do you see here regarding what their game plan is and how they'll execute it? If there's any lawsuits such as yourself coming into the limelight, how are they going to figure out a strategy to circumvent people like yourself?
Well, I don't think they can, and Phil, jump in here if you want, but I believe what we've done is, and maybe we should just mention this DVD that's been released by a brilliant filmmaker in Denver, Colorado, and he got into Field McConnell's brain and my brain, and he translated something that most people, don't necessarily get a handle on, because a crack fighter pilot like Field McConnell thinks exceedingly quickly, and he has great trouble putting in words what he would do in practice if someone's closing on him at a speed of 3,000 miles an hour. And similarly, a lot of people that I speak to, their eyes glaze over, and they can handle about 30 seconds, and then they want to go off and have a coffee. So the great challenge for Field and myself is really, once we think we've got a solution, is actually communicating it. And what this DVD, and it can be ordered off CaptainSherlock.com, has done brilliantly is create a visual image for what we think are the sequence of events that took place on 9-1-1. And from the defendant's point of view, the problem for them is the image is now out there. And I don't, if someone said to me how many members are there of Hortz Cafe, I think it would be millions, because I include in that membership people who've listened to shows like yours, Ladybug and Coast to Coast, which had an audience of 4 million people. So to the best of our efforts, Field and myself have tried to explain in words what we think we understand. That has been shared now with millions of people around the world who have developed a vision that I can't guarantee is exactly the same as my vision of what happened on 9-1-1, but it's a lot closer to the truth than these defendants would wish us to be. And so the defendants now are vastly outnumbered. I detect, reading and researching around the internet, panic is setting in. We're seeing a lot of kind of disinformation coming our way where people try and, in fact, today I got an email saying that Field McConnell should be appointed clown of the day. And I'm pointing out to this guy, I've just replied to him, it seems a little bizarre that you identify a crack fighter pilot as a clown of the day, when he's talking about the maneuvers that a jet plane can execute around the vicinity of the Pentagon. But what I'm saying is that I think they're panicking. I think they're going to make terrible timing errors, because I don't think these people are conspicuous in their courage to do what they did on 9-1-1. You basically have to go around the back of an enemy and stick a knife in them, which is, I think, what was done by Quebec and certain group of militant Marxists in Canada to what has been a proud and invaluable ally to freedoms in Canada for over 100 years.
Can I jump in?
Do you have any comment on that, Phil?
Yeah, I want to jump in from a layman's standpoint. You were asking questions about Ted Kaczynski and another couple of names you need to concentrate on are Ramsey Yosef and Timothy McVeigh. These three people were all in the same cell or in sequential cells in the same prison at one time. And it appears to me that the perpetrators of 9/11, as well as the other murder for hire, which has been going on for a long time, but let's not look backwards. Let's look forward and to see if there's other cases, hence post 9/11. And, I personally made a lot of this information available to the U.S. government on the 10th of December of 2006. Because David and I knew that the technology was deployed and the weapons were deployed, and I'm not going to misspeak here, Agent Ladybug or Eric. They could have, if they wish to, they being the perpetrators, they could have taken out 108 Boeing aircraft simultaneously as of December 10th. And I personally, and I'm not dragging David Hawkins in on this, he can speak for himself, but I identified a four-day period in December, which I thought, I don't have a criminal mind, but these people, they are criminal, and whether they have minds or not, they do make errors of redundancy. They keep going back to the same playbook. But post 9/11, there's been a cut, two airplanes that have been vaporized, and one of them was 21 days after I alerted the U.S. government. I told them on the 10th of December of 06 that there was a technology and weapons deployed that could take out 108 Boeings. And I was summarily dismissed. In fact, not even a courtesy to reply. 21 days later, on the 1st of January, 07, and you'll want to write this flight number down if you're not familiar with it, ADAM, A-D-A-M, ADAM Air Flight 574. It disappeared in Indonesia over the water where any evidence would be very difficult to retrieve. And it's my opinion that there was very little evidence left, because when these Boeings are vaporized, they turn into what David calls confetti. And what the people in Shanksville, where United 93 was vaporized, they talk about dust and nothing even the size of the end of a toothpick. The third one has now just occurred within the last week. Kenya Flight 507, and most of your listeners are probably well aware that Kenya lost an airplane. It was going from Cameroon to Kenya. It took off in a very heavy thunderstorm, which is not illegal. Some might question the judgment, but that's real easy to be a Monday morning quarterback. But there was very little found of Kenya 507. And Kenya 507 and ADAM Air 574 have a couple of startling similarities. Number one is they're both Boeing 737. And according to a Department of Justice investigation of Boeing aircraft that was settled within the last year, Boeing paid a $615 million fee to get the Department of Justice to terminate their investigation, which they summarily terminated once they got the $615 million. However, it's my allegation, and I'm speaking as an individual here, and David can chime in or seek distance, but I believe that had the U.S. government seriously investigated the information I gave them on December 10th, I doubt if ADAM Air 574 would have been vaporized. Therefore, I doubt if Kenya 507 would have been vaporized. But because the government, and this is the U.S. government, they have such total disregard and disrespect for the citizens, the little people like myself and David, they think that their corruption is more powerful than our truth. And we simply seek to prove to them that that's not the case. They need to be more respectful of their citizens. I, as a private citizen on 9/11 with my own eyeballs, based on my track record of being a pilot for about 35 years, I determined that what I was seeing and what was being reported were not the same thing. What the major media reported as we watched in horror as the buildings were attacked over and over, they kept playing allegedly United 175 all day long. And I found it very discouraging, but I also drew the conclusion almost instantly that we were being fed a fable, and we'd like to feed them something in the courthouse. Over to
now,
you.
Now, I have a question regarding also, is this something that's going to take place over and over again until you get more pilots in your courtyard, that they're going to use this vaporization? This is the latest modus operandi for getting rid of their targets. So there might be just one person in the plane that they want to get rid of, but all of these people that are in the plane would be vaporized. So this is a way that they can now do this over and over again. And it seemed to happen in England regarding one particular person that they were targeting, a banker that was on the bus. They diverted the passengers from the subway line onto the bus. They got this one target. So it seems to be an ongoing agenda that they're doing. What do you think of this thought?
Oh, absolutely. And the idea there, you see, is that they can mask the individual assassination by killing over 100 people. So if you take, for example, the Kenya bombing, we've identified, or there has been identified, what they would call a high-value target in the Kenya confetti bomb. And this was a British journalist. Actually, he worked for a local paper in the area of England that I used to live, the Richmond and Twickenham paper. Anyway, he became very, very well-known international crime reporter. And he was about, and this is a bombing that we alleged, well, the plane blew up on Saturday, and we believed that there was a confetti bomb used. And Anthony Mitchell, I think I'll just read it to you, if I may, Ladybug. Anthony Mitchell was killed in a plane crash in the Cameroons, an Associated Press correspondent. And he was on assignment to investigate a criminal trade in an endangered species for food. His stories were to be published before an international conference on the topic next month. Mitchell made headlines last month with investigation into the illegal detention and transfer of terror suspects from Kenya to Somalia and eventually into Ethiopian prisons. The story, stridently criticized by the Ethiopian government as coming from an ivory tower, where the war on terror was not understood. Mitchell's stories angered Ethiopian authorities. During the May 2005 election, Mitchell repeatedly uncovered government efforts to influence the vote's outcome. In January 2006, the Ethiopian government expelled him for what it called hostile reporting. Staff reporter for the AP, Associated Press, in the Nairobi Bureau the following August. He moved to Africa in 2001 to work and live in Ethiopia. He was one of the most widely respected journalists in the country. Before moving to Ethiopia, he worked for the Daily Express from 1996 to 2001, covering international affairs, conflicts in Kosovo and Sierra Leone. So this man was a huge authority on organized crime reaching the highest level of government, and in particular the affiliation between the justice departments and correction services in a country such as Ethiopia, and the movement of drugs and weapons and people smuggling and food from endangered species. So he would have been a tremendously valuable target to kill, particularly as he was going to expose an awful lot in a conference next month. Now, the way to get rid of him, which we believe they've perfected through this murder for hire network, is to use a technology of a military satellite called RadarSat that operates out of Gatineau in Quebec. And this was financed by the taxpayer, and it's been privatized to the control of Carlisle Canada. And RadarSat operators provide what is called a synthetic aperture radar ground motion or movement target indicator, meaning through the satellite and its synthetic aperture radar, they can track a moving target and steer a missile, a drone, and take it out, whether it's an Al-Qaeda agent in Afghanistan or Iraq, or a Canadian soldier, or an American soldier, because the people who sit behind RadarSat and its murder-for-hire network are clients of RadarSat who can afford to pay RadarSat for the information they need to target with a drone. And on 911, RadarSat was being used to target the simulated attack by Canada's Al-Qaeda red teams on high-value targets in the United States. But always the procedure is the same. Most career criminals, they get very lazy and very stupid. Whatever worked back in 1963 continues to work today. So, funnily enough, the absence of conventional evidence of an aircraft crash, for example, in the field outside Shanksville in Pennsylvania, when the eyewitnesses arrived and looked at the crater, they generally said, "Where's the plane?"